ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 18th of November. I'm Sabra Lang, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. If you're a Liberal opposition leader, look out. Federally, Susan Lee is dealing with speculation about her position. New South Wales' Mark Speakman is facing a possible challenge to his position before the week's out. And in Victoria, Brad Batten's expected to be challenged this morning. And if he's dumped, the party will be onto its third leader within a year, with 12 months to go until the next state election. Bridget Fitzgerald joins me now from Melbourne with the latest. Bridget, what do you know about this challenge?
Sabra, a group of MPs from across competing factions visited the opposition leader, Brad Batten, yesterday and told him he had lost support of the party room. So it's understood there'll be a leadership challenge this morning and that the shadow treasurer, Jess Wilson, who was appointed to that role just last month, will put her name forward to contest the leadership. So Brad Batten replaced John Pesutto in December last year, but it appears that he's been unable to unite the party, which has really been fractured for some time. So listeners might remember that Brad Batten replaced the former leader, John Pesutto, after Mr. Pesutto lost a high-profile court case where he was found to have defamed his Liberal Party colleague, MP Moira Deeming. So as you mentioned, Sabra, if Brad Batten is replaced, the Victorian Liberals would have had their third leader in 11 months.
And what's in particular has prompted today's movements?
Sabra, it appears to be down to polling and the Liberal Party's inability to gain ground against the Labor government. So Victoria is a year out from its state election and the Liberals have already been in opposition here for more than a decade. So Brad Batten, who's a former police officer, has made some inroads talking about crime and law and order. Crime rates have risen in Victoria and public safety is a really big issue for the community here. But it hasn't appeared to be enough to win over voters. Polling from just last month shows that Labor still leads the coalition despite these crime concerns. So if she is to put her name forward, Jess Wilson would be a fresh start for the Libs. She's a first-term MP for the blue ribbon seat of Kew, which is in Melbourne's inner east, and she's generally regarded as a strong performer for the party. Tony Barry, a former Liberal Party strategist and director of the Redbridge Group, a political research and strategy firm, says that there was a lift in support for the Liberals under John Pesutto's leadership, but that's since fallen away.
But unfortunately for Brad, his numbers fell after taking the leadership. So the government is now back ahead in the polls, around 52-48 in our last research that was published. And with a primary vote in the mid to late 30s, obviously the party room has decided that, you know, his leadership is no longer sustainable.
That's Tony Barry from the Redbridge Research and Strategy Firm, and before him, Bridget Fitzgerald in Melbourne. The federal government's locked in a fight with the states as crunch time approaches for its self-imposed deadline to secure a new public hospital funding deal. The ABC's revealed that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has written to state and territory leaders saying they need to bring hospital funding down to sustainable levels if they want a deal honoured. National Health reporter Stephanie Dalzell has the story.
Deal or no deal, the political version. This was Prime Minister Anthony Albanese outspruiking a public hospital funding agreement in January last year.
We have settled an arrangement with the support of every state and territory.
But that arrangement now has caveats. Under the original deal agreed to in 2023 by National Cabinet, the federal government would increase its share of public hospital funding to 42.5% by 2030 and 45% by 2035. However, the Prime Minister has written to the states and territories saying in order for that to be realised, they must bring hospital spending down to sustainable levels. It's angered health ministers, including Queensland's Tim Nicholls.
It was almost beyond belief that the Prime Minister would write to us saying we have to work to reduce growth in hospital activity. Does he want us to go out there and close the front door to our emergency departments or stop taking ambulances delivering sick patients to our emergency wards.
Australian Medical Association President Daniel McMullen says the states were given a commitment which should be honoured.
While we think that the public hospitals, of course, need to be thinking about innovative ways to provide care, we also need the Commonwealth Government paying their fair share.
The interim one-year funding deal currently in place expires in June, but the federal government has consistently said it wants this finalised by the end of the year. Tasmanian Health Minister Bridget Archer says for that to happen, the Commonwealth needs to come to the table.
I think if there's to be a deal by the end of the year, the federal government is really going to have to step up their negotiations.
The states and territories say under the deal on the table, the actual share of Commonwealth funding for public hospitals will be closer to 35%. South Australian Health Minister Chris Picton says he can't sign up to an agreement which will see the federal contribution continue to drop.
Patients around the country, of course, aren't interested in the argy-bargy of health negotiations and states and territories and the Commonwealth disputing funding formulas. But what they do want to see is a fair funding deal.
With negotiations stalled, Dr. McMullen says the consequences could be serious.
We've got patients in the community waiting in pain or with conditions that really do need to be treated. And so we need to meet that capacity.
In a statement, a federal government spokesperson said the Commonwealth's most recent offer included an additional $20 billion over 5 years for public hospitals, and that the Commonwealth was prepared to negotiate in good faith.
Stephanie Dalzell there. Next week is Federal Parliament's last sitting week for the year, with negotiations happening this week to try and land an agreement with updating Australia's decades-old environmental laws. The government doesn't have the numbers to get these new proposed laws through the Senate. It needs either the Coalition or the Greens senators to back it. Political reporter Romy Stevens filed this report.
Australia's environmental laws have remained largely unchanged for more than 20 years. The Business Council of Australia's chief executive, Bran Black, says the current system is broken and it's preventing projects from going ahead.
We know, for instance, that in the calendar years 2023 and 2024, there were 76 renewable energy projects that went into the system, and not one of those has as yet been assessed and approved.
BCA is one of 26 business groups calling for the Coalition and the federal government to work together to make sensible changes to update the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. Bran Black says having the two major parties agree on reforms will deliver business confidence and certainty.
No matter what side of politics you're on, we do agree that there needs to be more housing. We do agree that we need to deliver more energy projects. We agree that Australia needs to lean into the critical minerals opportunity. And we agree that Australia will require more infrastructure into the future.
The groups sent a letter to both the Environment Minister Murray Watt and his coalition counterpart Angie Bell last weekend, calling for 7 changes to Labor's current legislative proposal. That includes clarity on the powers for the new Federal Environment Protection Authority and for the government to ensure emissions declared by proponents are for the purpose of transparency and not considered as part of the project assessment process. Bran Black says the overhaul is critically important.
I wouldn't urge that we rush the reform. I'd make sure that we get it right, but I'd make sure that we prioritise it with sufficient urgency such that at the end of the day, we're legislating by the middle of next year.
But Labor is also negotiating with the Greens as the government looks to get the laws passed this year. Greens Environment spokesperson Sarah Hanson-Young says Labor risks tainting its climate legacy by doing a deal with the Coalition, particularly after the opposition ditched net zero.
How can a Labor government be taken seriously on environment and climate laws if they're going to negotiate with a party that doesn't even believe in the basic climate science?
Australian Conservation Foundation CEO Kelly O'Shaughnessy says the current package isn't good enough.
The major problem with Australian nature protection, the federal level, is the minister has the power to do whatever they want, really. They have too much discretion, and there's no clear rules in place that would say this is what you needed to protect nature.
Hearings for a Senate inquiry into the proposed EPBC reforms continue from Thursday, ahead of the final parliamentary sitting week of the year next week.
Romy Stevens there. A warning, the following story contains distressing details about family violence. When Queenslander Hannah Clark and her three children were set alight and murdered by her estranged husband 5 years ago, a senior police officer sparked outrage by suggesting detectives would consider if he'd been driven too far. The officer was taken off Hannah Clark's case, but now Guardian Australia is reporting fresh allegations of police and coronial failings. A former police officer says she's raised similar concerns about other cases, as Annie Guest reports.
Kate Porcina is a former Queensland Detective Senior Sergeant who reviewed deaths with links to domestic violence for the coroner. In 2020, she alleged police mishandled DV investigations and withheld information, including not listing a woman as missing or connecting her suicide to DV.
When I compiled that report, it was provided to the coroner as requested, and then it was also provided to my detective inspector, who then told me that I was not to forward information to the coroner without it going through him first, as I was to protect the organisation's reputation at all costs.
Kate Porcina had previously complained about superior officers, and after lodging a complaint about bullying in this case, she left the police. Now another whistleblower has come forward telling Guardian Australia she worked in the Queensland coronial system when police reviewed their involvement with Hannah Clark before her estranged husband, Rowan Baxter, murdered her and their three children in 2020.
The second whistleblower that has come forward saw a report that questioned the accuracy and veracity of the complaints made by Hannah Clark.
Hannah Clark was already dead when police were allegedly still questioning whether she'd been telling the truth. And the police review was allegedly done by an officer who'd earlier been involved in the case before the murder. Kate Porcina again.
This report was compiled 3 weeks after they were incinerated in their vehicle.
The whistleblower who worked in the Queensland coronial system is represented by the Human Rights Law Centre's Kieran Pender.
Our client was concerned about a culture of inadequate investigations of the deaths of women and children following domestic and family violence. And this reporting has revealed a disturbing pattern of women and children's lives being put in danger due to significant police failures, which then remained hidden during subsequent coronial processes.
Queensland Police declined an interview. In a statement, it didn't directly challenge any of the allegations, instead saying there are robust internal and external systems to ensure accountability, including a unit dealing with allegations relating to police handling of domestic violence and allegations of sexism, misogyny, homophobia and racism. These were characteristics described as cultural problems in the service by Queensland's Human Rights Commissioner last year. Catherine Burney is from the Working With Women Alliance.
Hannah's case is the pointy end of a horrific crisis. But this is happening every day across the country in every jurisdiction to people looking for help.
A spokesperson for the Queensland Coroner's Court says a coronial investigation is an independent, impartial, open and transparent process, and there are several avenues of review if a person is not satisfied with an outcome or decision.
Any guest there? With Christmas looming, shoppers are being warned about the dangers of buying toys online thanks to an investigation by the consumer group Choice. It tested 24 products and found the majority failed button battery safety standards. If swallowed, the small batteries can cause terrible and life-threatening injuries. Isabel Masali reports.
As families look to online retailers to save money this Christmas, consumer group Choice has made its own naughty or nice list.
What we found is that 17 out of 24 of the toys containing button batteries that we purchased failed to comply with the button battery safety standard.
The group's Rosie Thomas says five products from Kogan passed the safety tests, but it found issues with various toys from the retailers Shein, AliExpress, eBay and Amazon. That includes a toy watch, rubber bath toys and keychains.
We found they had serious safety failures, such as battery compartments that could be accessed without a tool, missing warning labels, or screws that could be lost easily while you're changing the batteries.
Button batteries are small enough to be easily swallowed and can get stuck in the esophagus or digestive system, potentially killing or seriously injuring a child within hours.
We are still finding unsafe button battery products on online marketplaces several years after the mandatory safety standards came into effect.
KidSafe Queensland President Dr. Ruth Barker is an emergency paediatrician who sees the damage these batteries cause.
The issue with button battery safety is really like a game of whack-a-mole. And even since the regulation became enforceable a couple of years ago, we're still seeing countless products that are being recalled by the ACCC.
Choice shared its test results with the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and with the online marketplaces that sold the products.
AliExpress completely rejected our findings and said they were unsubstantiated, and that they held that position even after we appealed their initial determination. Shein, on the other hand, hasn't responded to our report. Amazon and eBay have responded promptly to Choice's report and have confirmed that they have removed those products and similar products from their marketplace.
In a statement to IM, Shein confirmed the problematic products have been removed from sale. It said it takes product safety seriously, and upon learning of claims of non-compliance, it immediately removes the item as a precaution while the company investigates. Amazon also confirmed its products have been removed and said those offered in the store must comply with laws and regulations. But Dr. Ruth Barker reminds parents it's not just unsafe toys that are putting kids at risk. She says button batteries are used in various household products and families need to look for alternatives where possible.
We have been tracking this issue for quite a while and we're still seeing roughly 20 kids a week presenting to emergency departments around the country with a suspected button battery exposure.
Choice has used this latest investigation to call for stronger laws to ensure online marketplaces are held responsible for the products they sell.
Isabel Masali. In Western Serbia, angry locals say they'll keep fighting against Rio Tinto, which has announced it'll mothball a controversial $3.6 billion lithium mine project there. The ABC has obtained an internal memo from the British Australian mining giant saying it'll keep the site in Yadda Valley but pause work on turning it into a mine, with opponents cautious about celebrating that as a win. Europe Bureau Chief Mazoe Ford reports.
Local opposition to the proposed Rio Tinto underground lithium mine in Serbia's Jadar Valley has been long-standing and loud. Now the project's been paused, but the activists won't be silenced.
Because until they pack their bags, close their offices and give back the land they've bought and sell it back to the locals, there's no reason for us to think that they've gone away.
Serbian-Australian actor Bojana Novaković has been one of the leading figures in the protest movement against Rio Tinto's plans to build the mine.
This would be the first ever lithium mine built on fertile soil and populated land. And so it would open the floodgates, I think, if we allowed it to happen.
After finding Europe's largest and most valuable deposit of lithium in the Jadar Valley, Rio Tinto was hoping to extract 2.3 million tonnes of the mineral. The British-Australian mining giant said that that amount of what many call white gold would have been enough to make batteries for 1 million electric vehicles a year for several decades. A year ago, the ABC travelled to the Jadar Valley and nearby town Loznica to see the area for ourselves. This is how Managing Director Chad Blewett sold the project.
We've got enough for at least 40 years of mining, and that would be the largest, longest life, highest grade deposit in all of Europe.
Now the ABC has obtained an internal memo saying the Jadar project will be moving into a care and maintenance phase, meaning Rio Tinto will keep and maintain the land it owns, but pause all work towards turning it into a mine. The company says it's simplifying its operations and prioritising other projects, but it also points to difficulty in gaining permits from the Serbian government. This is the second time the controversial Jadar project has been paused, though last time it was done by the Serbian government ahead of an election. The political landscape is unstable once again, but Rio Tinto is keeping its options open. Dr. Gavin Mudd, the director of the Critical Minerals Intelligence Centre at the British Geological Survey, says lithium's value is undeniable, but there's more at stake.
It's been growing very, very rapidly, and we still need it to grow rapidly into the future to make sure we can achieve both the energy transition and our net zero climate ambitions globally. So the questions that we have to grapple with is where are the right places to mine under what conditions, and what are the sort of standards at which we do that?
Dr. Gavin Mudd from the British Geological Survey, ending Mazzoli Ford's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As you would have seen, the Liberals and Nationals have now officially dumped net zero emission targets from their climate and energy policy. It keeps the coalition together. But what do voters think? Today, pollster, former Labor strategist and director of the Redbridge Group, Cos Samaras, on whether it's a winning strategy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.